On this episode, my special guest is Lisa Smart, author of a very inspiring book, Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Dying to Live. You know, a person's last words often take on an eerie significance, giving clues about the ultimate fate of the human soul. Well, until recently, no one had systematically studied end-of-life communication by using examples from ordinary people. Linguist Lisa Smart changed all of that with the Final Words Project, which she established in conjunction with world-renowned afterlife expert Raymond Moody. The project chronicles the linguistic patterns and themes behind the words people speak as they leave this world behind. Lisa Smart is a linguist, educator, and poet. She founded the Final Words Project, an ongoing study devoted to collecting and interpreting the mysterious language at the end of lives. And she co-facilitates workshops about language and consciousness with the great Raymond Moody at universities, hospices, and conferences. And she lives in a beautiful San Francisco Bay Area, and it's from that area that she's joining me today. Lisa Smart, it's a joy to have you on the program today.
Great to be here.
I've been reading a lot about this book and other interviews you've done, especially in some magazines and in some newspapers. And with my hospice background, of course, I was incredibly excited to not only read this book, but to now have you on the show. In the bio, I also talked about the Final Words Project you've been involved with. Can you share a little bit more about that?
I established the Final Words Project in 2014 with the guidance and friendship of Dr. Raymond Moody. And I began the project because my background is in linguistics. And in the last few weeks of my father's life, I noticed a lot of changes in his language as I sat bedside with him, and I was not only a grieving daughter but a curious linguist, and wrote down everything he said, and afterwards became very curious about people's final words. And there was very little literature at the time about it. There was The Wonderful Final Gifts, which is just a great book by two hospice nurses.
Yes.
But besides that, there was nothing else, and so I decided, well, if it's not out there, I'm going to do it. So I established the Final Words Project to collect more information about people's final words.
Yeah, you mentioned you were a linguist. My all-time favorite speaker, I still watch the DVDs, was Dr. Leo Buscaglia, who was popular back in the day. And a lot of people thought he was a psychologist, but he was a linguist also at USC.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed him. So that's great. More honor for the field.
So now I know two special linguists, one past, although people like you and Raymond probably talk to him all the time. But now you use a phrase in your book that I love, and it's about the last words of the dying, but you say sanctified language at the end of life. That was just so poetic.
Oh, and it really, as I entered the realm of the threshold or began to study the words as people were dying, I was absolutely in awe of and amazed by how the quality of the language. I've always loved poetry as well, and much of the language was so, it did seem sanctified. It was, as I said, almost poetic. And of course, because of the circumstances around it, I just held every word with sanctity because they were my father's final words. And I feel like many people involved in the project who've transcribed their loved one's words have that same feeling about them.
Yeah. What was it about your dad's last words that you found so fascinating?
Well, first of all, my dad was a skeptic.
Ah.
And so before the dying process, he was someone who was very bright.
Uh-huh.
He had a PhD and very analytical and rational. And whenever I made any kind of references, I was never super, super spiritual, but I would make references to things like angels every once in a while. And he would just roll his eyes and just, he believed in nothing, absolutely nothing, complete rationalist. So one of the things that piqued my interest was just as he began the dying process, the last 3 weeks, he started talking about angels in the room to me. And one day, when it first began, he said, "Oh my goodness, Lisa, you were right about angels." And I I was so awestruck by that. And I had, even before that, began writing down his words, because they were, what did I notice? I noticed they were very metaphoric. I was baffled. Mm-hmm. He said things like, there is so much so in sorrow. And I thought, boy, that is like poetry, because logically and literally that sentence doesn't, it's nonsensical. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
But from the heart, when we receive those words from the heart, they do, right? They, you know, what I heard him saying is, oh my God, this is so sad that we're leaving each other. There's so much grief here for both of us, right?
Wow. You also write that one day, it wasn't, I don't think, his last words, but he said, the angels say enough. Only 3 days left. So the angels were speaking to him. Here's a man who was a skeptic all of his life.
Exactly. And boy, did that change a lot of my worldviews as I witnessed this. Hmm. And now I've come to find it's not that unusual. It's not that unusual. It's just no one, I mean, many people now have done, David Kessler, Christopher Kerr, there has been research about bedside figures. I'm certainly not the first to do that, but to collect the language and just hear how these conversations are taking place. And then in my dad's case, too, with something common, there was that sort of a premonition that he knew something. He knew that he'd be passing in 3 days. The angels told him, apparently, and it was true. 3 days later, he passed on.
Did your dad's experience and what you experienced with him, did that alter or change at that time how you view afterlife?
Oh, completely. I mean, it began the process. I mean, the process wasn't complete at that moment. But first, my father, he was someone who was terrified of death, terrified. Mm-hmm. And, you know, before we'd go on an airplane, he would make sure he had lots and lots of liquor. You know, he was just really, really, really afraid of dying because he didn't have any spiritual framework. So, of course, he was terrified.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I witnessed in those 3 weeks, now, of course, he had days where there was, you know, agitation. It was hard. I mean, I'm not trying to sugarcoat the process at all. But what I saw is that there was this deepening. And through the process, one day he looked up to me and he said, I said, Daddy, how are you doing? And he said, you know, I'm working on myself, Lisa. I'm working on myself. Hmm. And I really get this. And he was a psychologist, so he was accustomed to this sort of internal reflection. But I got this feeling like he was truly going somewhere deep inside to make peace with what was happening. And gratefully, his dying process was relatively peaceful and easy and very graceful. And he retained a lot of his speech to the very end, which is not the case for everyone at all.
Yeah, yeah.
But in his case, it was.
Yeah. Well, speaking of afterlife, you created the Final Words Project with the great Raymond Moody, who coined the term near-death experience, and that best-selling book, I remember when it came out, Life After Life. How did your partnership with Raymond come to be?
So magical. I'm just so grateful for it. I remember when I was 17, I can remember the moment, I was lying on the rug in my bedroom reading the book, and I'm like so many of us with bated breath,
yeah.
I'm like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
And then the way I met him is, as I mentioned, after my father passed, I became really curious about final words and the language of end of life. So I went up to the library at UC Berkeley, which was just up the street from my parents and where I went to school, looked up what kind of material, you know, the journal articles about language of the dying. There was absolutely nothing, and except for maybe the way doctors speak to patients, you know, more very clinical, but not linguistic. And so I just started reading everything I could. I reread Raymond's book, and then synchronistically, my mother was at Temple one day and spoke to one of the congregants, and he asked how I was doing with my father, you know, with the loss of my father, because we were very close.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, great, but she's gotten really almost obsessed with this idea of final words. And And then he said, you know, that's funny. I'm going to be co-teaching a workshop with Raymond Moody in Alabama in a few weeks. I wonder if she might want to just come and check it out. And it just happened about 10 days later, my tax refund came. Oh, thank you, God, or whoever. So I just did it, right? And it was a five-day retreat. And the fourth day, he started talking about, you know, we all know him as you know, an MD or when he was in medical school, but he also has a PhD in philosophy. And his first love was unintelligible language or nonsensical language. He loves language. So on the fourth day, he said, I've been looking for someone who, a linguist who might be interested in studying final words. And I was like, oh, my goodness. So I was living in Napa, California. I had a great job, had a great life there, but I knew I had to come to Georgia and work with Raymond. I just knew it.
Yeah.
So we sold everything. I have the most wonderful husband. Our kids were all grown, and we just got in the car and I started work with. I mean, obviously, I commuted back and forth by airplane for about a year as I got to know Raymond.
Sure.
But when I felt the connection was right, I just came out here and followed my heart, and I have no regrets. No regrets. I'm making less money than I was before and all that kind of thing, but I am so much happier.
That almost opens up a whole nother interview, which we won't get into now, but about life purpose and following your destiny. And, I mean, wow, that's really great for you guys to do that.
Yeah, you have to. Yes, at moments I wondered what I had done. Believe me.
Did your husband ever wonder?
Yes, and I have a terrific husband. But listen about this other synchronicity, which is so magical. Turns out that Raymond and my husband went to the same elementary school at the same time.
No way. Really?
Yes.
That is wild.
That is
wild.
That is just too crazy. So we just found that out about 8 months ago. so my husband loves Georgia, and so he's really happy to be back. It's all worked out. But Raymond Moody is really a terrific human being. I'm just so, so blessed to have him in my life.
You know, with all the books I've read over the years in Death and Dying, this has been the first book, your book, Words at the Threshold, that really addresses the last words of the dying. And it makes me wonder, how did you collect all the data for your research?
It was very difficult in the beginning, and I knew nothing. I mean, you've been in hospice, and you know a lot about it. Well, I knew nothing, and as a linguist, basically, if you want to know something about language, you walk in there with your digital recorder, know, and you sit down and you ask people to talk. I was looking back, I almost blush because I was so kind of clunky and awkward about, can I leave this recorder at the bedside? And very quickly I learned about being real, oh my goodness, about it's not just collecting the data, but it's how you collect the data. And I made a decision pretty early on that I wanted to be as healing as it was, fruitful and productive in terms of getting the material. So while at first I had this vision of having digital recorders at the bedsides, it turned more into people just share, inviting people, family members, friends, and so forth, loved ones, to just transcribe and to pick and choose what they want to share with me, because there's a lot of very sensitive and private and fragile conversations often at the end of life. And, obviously I grew to understand that very, very quickly. So, as I say in my book, this is not hardcore science, the Final Words Project. It's the first step.
Yes.
And so basically people just transcribed, and some medical professionals, of course, they didn't give me the exact words of people because we honor people's privacy, but they would give me kind of trends that they saw or patterns or things that they had noticed.
Mm-hmm.
But we now have, I have a website, and people can just share their story of their loved one's words. And we have now, I think we're up to about over 200 people and representing about 2,000 utterances.
Oh, that's awesome. That's
awesome.
I know,
it's really, and the patterns just shook, really many of the patterns became clear pretty quickly.
Yeah, yeah. Are the people you studied, are they primarily older or in hospice?
That's a great question. Yeah, I would say generally yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it would be easier to get a hold of that. And but you're kind of like a pioneer yourself now in this area, I would think.
I am. And like many pioneers, in the beginning, I had so many doors, you know, and also because I didn't know enough. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Not only was I a pioneer, but I was a newbie, you know, and I had a lot to learn. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I had a lot of doors closed on me. And even when I approached certain universities, at first I thought I'd want to do this for a PhD, graduate work.
Yeah.
And a lot of schools were very uncomfortable with the material because of the ethical concerns, but also because this is quickly shifting in our lifetime. But even just 7 years ago, was it seven? No, it was a little less than that. But even many years ago when I started this process, people were very uncomfortable with my interest in death and dying in this way. And then when I went to linguistics departments, oh, my God, they looked at me like I was crazy.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
You know, and they were like, oh, is it that you want to research dying languages, you know, like extinct languages? And I was like, no, the language of the dying.
Yes, yes. Well, I got to tell you, I mean, hanging out with Raymond Moody like you do and have, that's worth two or three PhDs right there, I would think.
Oh, if you're not kidding. I feel like every time we speak, you know, a couple times a week, and every conversation I walk away with some new nugget about something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we laughed about some of the responses when they heard what you were doing from some of the people. But the last words of the dying are sometimes disregarded as a result of delirium or medication. But there really is something else going on, isn't there? Like you witnessed with your own father.
Yes, I think so. I mean, you know, one of the things that this is what Raymond first heard when he began with NDEs. Oh, it's just hypoxia, right? It's all just some, or it's just the meds. And yet there are the patterns we see, as I mentioned earlier, the book Final Gifts also talked about this. We see a lot of metaphor. So people start talking about trips that loved ones don't understand because they're like, there's no trip going on here. Or, you know, where's my bus? Where's the bus? Where's my Jetta? Where's my car? Where's my passport? And people start talking, you know, in these metaphors of a trip coming and needing to go somewhere. And people might talk about going home, and loved ones may be confused. You're home, Mama, you're home. Or, no, you can't go home. But people often just want to hear that, of course you're going home.
That's a great point, because there's been several times when I've been with a patient and family that's come up. And, of course, the family doesn't understand what they're trying to say, so they think they're talking about their physical home. But what you're saying is, no, there's something deeper going on here.
What's remarkable to me about doing this work, and now I'm getting cross-linguistic samples, you know, from other countries, other languages, I beg your pardon, and we're finding similar themes, you know, this whole thing about going home, and also the travel theme, which, you know, we see in the literature going back hundreds of years, right, the images of the, you know, of the boat, you know, the River Styx and so forth, this image of death as a voyage, and it's in the languages, people are dying, and my father, of course, was a gambler, and he loved to gamble, so he started talking about the big trip to Las Vegas. Of course it was Las Vegas for him, you know.
Yeah,
you know, I just spoke to one nurse. The patient was saying, I need my Jetta. And you know, the wife was getting very frustrated, but this very skilled nurse said, yes, sir, we're going to gas it up and get it all ready for you.
I'll have to warn my children that if I start talking about Jimmy Buffett, Margaritaville, I'm really talking about the afterlife. So.
What a wonderful afterlife.
Yeah, I would think
I'll
so.
I'll be there with you.
Okay, there you go. Can you give us, I'm fascinated by this, can you give us a few examples of some famous last words that were uttered by people?
Sure. Well, I think one that many have heard already is Steve Jobs. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
You know, that one's chilling, by the way, isn't it? Wow. Yeah, that he would say that.
And my understanding is that those were literally his last words, so that he was looking out somewhere, or seemed to be, so that makes it particularly powerful, because you wonder, what is he witnessing?
What about Bob Hope?
Oh, yeah, that one is pretty, I don't know if I can get his timing, but so bear with me. But so his wife and he had never planned for his burial, even though he was relatively old when he passed, but they had never really planned about where. So she said, "Bob, we never planned. Where do you want to be buried?" And he looked and he said, "Hey, surprise me."
He was Bob Hope till the very end, wasn't he? That's interesting.
Well, you know, what you just said is actually very common, that we are who we are to the very end. Mm. And one of the famous last words I love is Jeffrey Holder, who is a dancer.
Yes, oh yes.
And his son shared his father's last words, which were arms 2, 3, 4, turn 2, 3, 4, down.
Wow.
2, 3, 4, yeah.
It reminds me of Gandhi when he was gunned down. They say his last words were Ram, 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 God.
Wow, I didn't know that. Thank you. I have to write that down.
That'll be in your sequel.
Okay. Definitely.
But I guess it is so much a part of us that would make sense. I know David Kessler said that when it comes to heaven or nirvana or whatever, his thoughts were, well, if you're Buddhist, you'll probably see a Buddha. If you're Christian, you'll probably see Jesus. And he went on, and that made sense to me.
Yes, and we see that with near-death experiences. And it seems to me, well, you think about language. If you think about an apple, it's the same object, right? You've got this apple, but, you know, in Spanish it's manzana. You know, in English it's apple. In French it's pom. You know, every place it's a different language, different representation, right? But
yeah. But
it's the same thing. So even though Jesus looks very different than Buddha.
Yes.
So, you know, manzana looks really different than apple on the surface. So there's something there to me about those very essential concepts, whether they're tangible or intangible, and we just have different words for them. And when, you know, near-death experiencers talk about the being of light.
Yes.
And that has no real assignment in terms of identity, right, beyond just being a being of light, and that seems to be what might be true.
You discovered a lot of fascinating things in your research. Can you talk a little bit about terminal lucidity?
Oh, yes, and this is certainly not my original research. I just I noticed it in the language of those people.
Yes.
In our sample, but other people obviously have written about it. But there, and there's a big research study being done right now, and I think we're all going to hear about it in the next couple of years, I hope. Do you know his name? I think it's Beth. I can never say it right. Bethany? Do you know how to pronounce his name? He's doing a very large-scale research, and I never can say his name, so bear with me. But
sure. Keep
your eyes open, because I think he's working on a book.
Okay.
But terminal lucidity, it's not uncommon, and maybe you've seen this in hospice, that right before someone dies, they'll have this moment where they seem like they've had a miraculous recovery, or they become, maybe if someone's been unresponsive for several weeks or days or even months, they might come up for a few minutes, a few seconds, even a few hours. And many times it involves food, like someone who may not have eaten for days, weeks, maybe even, well, probably days. Or they may come suddenly. My father, right before he passed, wanted pot roast and pineapple upside down cake, which of course I happily obliged him.
Yes.
And my father-in-law even, you know, wanted a beer out on the balcony, and so there's this period that I've heard called kind of the sunset day or time, but lucidity is light and clarity, so there was someone in a coma who came up and looked at his partner and just said, "It's not what you think." and then went back into the coma, or someone else said, tell everyone I'm okay and that I love them.
Yeah.
One person said, do you think I enjoy being like this?
I just find all this fascinating. I really do. And then the things that you have discovered and also share in this book. This book, I think, is a must read for everybody because, like I've often said, death is the most democratic thing on the face of the earth. It will affect all of us. In your opinion, Lisa, what does end-of-life speech say about consciousness?
Oh, my. It says to me that it shifts as we're dying, and that consciousness it survives and or changes in ways that I don't fully understand.
Mm-hmm.
But leaves me with hope and curiosity.
Mm.
But definitely, for example, do we have more time?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. For example, one of the things I noticed is something that I call sustained narrative.
Uh-huh.
So here you look at the brain, which is, you know, on decline. Obviously, someone's dying, you would think, along with their other bodily functions, the brain is disabled or increasingly dysfunctional. And yet, you'll have someone maybe start a story, maybe, let's say, 2 weeks before the person dies, they'll start talking about the train that they're waiting for but having trouble on the tracks.
Yeah.
This is one person that did a really meticulous job of transcription. So she had this one entry about from her dad, and she wrote it. A couple days later, he said, track malfunction fixed. Now, in isolation, that just sounds like sheer nonsense. What
mm-hmm.
the heck
right.
is that talking about, right?
Yeah.
That then, a few more days, we're on track. Okay.
Wow.
A few more days. And anyway, and it progresses. And then as his death approaches, suddenly the train's approaching the station.
Hmm.
My bags are packed and so forth. But if you look, there is this narrative, this story that's being sustained over a period of time. So the question for me is, how is a brain that's completely disabled and is functioning able to have this story
yes.
play out and
yes.
unfold? What is that? What is doing that? What is, I mean, I can't, if you ask me what I was thinking or said to someone 3 nights ago, I don't think I could tell you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So something like a sustained narrative, really, and there were several cases of that where people had these stories, and oftentimes they were evolutionary. So, you know, someone, I need to get ready for the big party, and then a few more days later, Aunt Mary said she can come too, or whatever, and then there's sort of this progression. And I think what happens is because no one has studied the speech and captured it, people just heard these isolated phrases, so it just seemed like sheer nonsense. But then once we start tracking this language and seeing the patterns where they exist, it's hard not to think that some other form of thought, like non-local consciousness, is influencing in some ways or shaping the words that are coming out of people's mouths.
You know, I find this all so fascinating in the DVD, Death Makes Life Possible, that Institute of Noetic Science has produced.
Mm.
They documented research currently going on at, I believe it's University of Virginia and University mm-hmm. of London. Maybe there's other places. And it's a little complicated. I can't share how they're doing this, but they're trying to come up with documentation how consciousness will continue on into eternity.
Mm. Wow.
I know. That's all I can say is, well, Steve Jobs, oh, wow. Oh, wow. And I wanted to ask you another question, though. What do you mean when you say that children and the dying seem to share a common language? I found that really fascinating.
Oh, it was so fascinating. One is there are a couple of stories. For example, a grandfather was in bed, passing, and just one of the toddlers got up. I think it was the grandchild, mm-hmm. and got up, and they just started kind of speaking nonsense or, you know, broken English together. But it was like they were on a wavelength together. And then there was another case where there was an old gentleman who was also in his final days, and he saw, again, I think it was a great niece or nephew, and said something like, that child is between the worlds. He said, the child is between the worlds. And it was as if they recognized each other. And also, in stories that I collected, many times children will say to their families that they see things in the room that the person who's dying also sees, like, oh, there's a little girl or a dog or a pet.
Yeah.
And there's not hundreds and hundreds or anything of cases, but there were enough to catch my attention. And kids definitely seem to be tuned into the things. One child described when her mother died how she saw a ladder going up from the bed to the ceiling. She saw this ladder. We know it's not that uncommon to hear people who are passing to talk about some kind of ladder or needing to go up the stairs.
Yeah.
Lisa,
that's always fascinated me. I can't tell you how many times I've had an intuitive or psychic or somebody like that come on the program and share that they've had this gift, this incredible talent, since they were kids. But some of them would say, but it was never encouraged by my parents, or definitely not encouraged by the school system. And there is something innocent and pure and I think magical about being a child.
Yes, I think it's true. And I think that there is a way that we are connected. Well, I mean, language is a great blessing, and it's wonderful to have language. But it also, it's like a funnel that funnels our minds then into seeing the world. You know, this is a cup. And, you know, Richard, this is a cup. But when you're younger, you see all the edges beyond what something is in literal reality. You don't just see a cup when you look at a cup. You see the colors around it. You know, who knows? I mean, it's been long enough since I've been a child. I can't remember quite how I perceive things. But it's like language is, again, a great blessing. But the more, you know, it's almost in the beginning of life, we don't have language, hasn't crystallized our thoughts and defined how we see the world. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens as we're dying. It's almost like we are letting go, you know, of language. And when we're first born, we have the capacity of producing hundreds of phonemes, those sounds in language. We can produce, you know, we can speak any language. We come in here blank slates, and by 6 months, you know, there's this crystallization that goes on that limits, you know, our ability to some degree. I mean, not completely, of course, but to some degree, we have less and less capacity and get more and more focused on our native language or languages. And I think that's the same process that begins to go on with our perceptions to some degree, because that's what's rewarded and that's what we see. But I also think that it's always there for us to tap. One of the things I'm really, really interested in is before I did this work, I worked with people who had learning disabilities, specifically dyslexia. And so those are people who see the world and process things really differently. And oftentimes people who are dyslexic are highly intuitive, right? And they see things in symbols, as many psychics do, and I imagine children do before language takes over. It's more, oftentimes it's more symbolic.
Mm-hmm.
And I also know that people who've been sexually abused, like when I was working with people who had learning disabilities, a percentage of them were abused as kids, and there was this kind of disorientation that took place, and they were tapped into seeing the world in different ways, more symbolically. But I'm really interested in the whole process about this ability we have to see things in images and also to feel things in vibrations.
Yes.
And it's also another form of communication, like, of course, but it's not the one on which the school system is based.
Exactly. Exactly. So what tips do you have to offer for loved ones or healthcare providers on how to respond to the speech of the dying?
Well, I think the first is, you know, enter the world of the person dying. So, and sometimes it can help to keep a final words journal if you're someone like me who finds solace and focus in writing. But I think enter into the world up first and have eyes for the sacred. Imagine that everything you're seeing is sacred. I mean, it's so scary and hard to watch someone you love. I mean, not always, but often it's scary and hard to watch someone we love dying. And yet to also remember there really is something sacred going on. You know, we know that in birth, but we don't always know that in death. Of course we don't. But there is something really sacred going on, I believe. And to at least, if you don't feel and believe that, see if you can imagine finding the sacred in what's happening. Always validate the person's words and experiences. So if someone starts talking about needing a passport to go to the other country, instead of saying, oh, come on, Grandma, what are you talking about? You're not going anywhere. You're stuck in this bed. Try to meet where they are and validate that person's, you know, oh, yes, we'll find the passport for you. Or, Grandma, tell me about that country or something. Be a student of the language. Listen closely and learn from the language if you can. Ask questions authentically. One of the biggest regrets I have, besides just losing my papa, I also regret that when he started talking about the angels, I didn't ask him what he was seeing.
Oh, yeah.
I wish we could have had an amazing conversation. And then one day, he got a pencil, and he stuck the pencil into his belt, like kind of like pointing to his belly, and he said, I'm trying to get it to the other side. And, of course, at the time, I didn't know what to say. All I could say is, Daddy, give me that pencil, you know, because I didn't know then about now. I would have said, oh, it's trying to get to the other side. Tell me more about that. Tell me, you know. So there's so much rich language going on, and if we keep our ears wide open, sometimes we can hear it. And assume your loved one hears you even when unresponsive. All the research shows that people, even if it seems they don't hear you, do. And finally, there's a lot of silence often at the end of life. And savor it. Meditate into it. Imagine that your loved one can hear you or feel you at least.
Yeah. Yeah, the assume your loved one hears you even when unresponsive to me is huge. I can't tell you how many times I might have been even in an assisted living in a room and a healthcare worker's got Jerry Springer blaring on the TV. Or people just don't have a sense of that unless they're reminded of that. So I'm glad you bring that up.
It's just such a gentle, soft time. You know, just the same thing often when a baby's being born.
Ah, yes.
You know, you don't want to have Jerry Springer going when a baby's being born, you know?
No. Right, right. I want to ask you a question. First of all, Raymond Moody writes a wonderful foreword for your book, so that's pretty cool. And you've got a lot of great people who are offering praise for this work, and I am too, although I'm not in their league. But Eben Alexander, though, wrote something I'd like for you to comment on, and he said, the words of the dying provide some of the most salient clues as to how we can best live our lives on Earth. I was really intrigued by that comment.
I think there are so many levels to that. One is you had asked a little bit about terminal lucidity, and
yes.
I was talking about the sunset day when people might become more lucid before they pass on.
And
one of the things that I noticed in all the words that during that period, we don't hear angry, you know, we don't hear people saying, like, Richard, I wish you had married a whole other woman. I mean, that was terrible. You don't hear those kinds of words. What you hear are always words of reconciliation or words.
Okay.
And in some case, we heard one mother describe to her son, she had Alzheimer's, then she was in a coma. She came up for about 2 or 3 hours, I believe, and told him where all the financial records in her studio, I mean, her study were kept. That was one of the most startling cases to me. And, however, all the words that we have tracked during that period are words of forgiveness, reconciliation.
There you go.
and reaching out. So I think part of what Eben's talking about is that really people are always, almost always, I mean, there are exceptions, but almost always reaching for some kind of reconciliation. And it's so important around the bedside to try to find as many connecting and loving points as possible. And then the other thing is, you know, we do hear things like mothers saying to their daughters, oh, my God, this is so beautiful, honey. I can't tell you how beautiful this is, talking about some, quote, imaginary, unquote, landscape they're seeing before them as they're dying. And there's a great lesson in that, too, in knowing that maybe we are, you know, maybe there is something beautiful waiting for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lisa, can you share a web address with us, please?
Oh, definitely. Thank you. www.finalwordsproject.org, and I've got lots of good information there. And if anybody has an account they would like to share, it's pretty easy to do online. We're still collecting data.
Mm. The book is Words at a Threshold, What We Say As We're Nearing Death. The author is Lisa Smart. And Lisa, it has been such an honor to have you on today's program. And thank you so much for the work that you're doing in the world regarding this topic.
You too, Richard. And thank you. Thanks so much for this opportunity.
Once again, that website is finalwordsproject.org. I want to thank you for joining me today. Also want to thank my engineer, Thomas Gismondi, and production coordinator for Angel Richardson. I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Dying to Live.